Hello, neighbours. Welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Emke, your host. This is episode 39 of season 2. One of the themes of today's show is the need for local food infrastructure, not just to feed ourselves, but also to attract and keep people in a region. This is especially important in remote areas that experience regular food insecurity. While our guest is generally speaking of her experience in the Northwest Territories, these are issues that communities in Newfoundland and Labrador struggle with as well. How often do communities try to recruit new residents, professionals and otherwise, by talking about sports or recreation or civic infrastructure or how close it is to an airport so you can escape? But rarely do they talk about local food access. In these days of climate challenge and supply chain weakening, maybe expecting to continue to survive at the end of the food chain is a bit naive. Maybe we need to tighten our suspenders and start growing more locally and then reprint those community-boosting brochures.
And having food that is fresh and local is a huge draw to anyone considering the North. I have no idea what zone I'm in. I'm not in a zone. I'm in zone zero. And what difference does it make when you don't have a road to get you the stuff? What part of the caribou does the carrot, the potato, and the onion in my beautiful caribou stew come from? At the end of the day, we're all here for the same thing. We want food, we want empowerment, we want jobs, we want all of those things, and we want them to better each of these small communities. So the people that currently live in those small communities say, why would I leave?
As I promised last week, we're back again with Rae Solotke from her home in Inuvik, Northwest Territories. We'll be talking about the complications and delights, and sometimes politics, of feeding people in the North. The show begins with us in mid-conversation about the importance of self-provisioning, hunting, gathering, growing, raising, focusing on culturally relevant foods. But there are challenges to these endeavors, often political and municipal, but also related to traditional harvesting values and norms. I ask her how this is playing out in the North.
I think that's a really interesting conversation. I love these conversations. That's my passion. I love to go to conferences where we talk about food security and food sovereignty and discuss the cultural differences and choices for food. And I've had a lot of arguments with both Inuvialuit and Gwich'in people from this region on the idea that food should be free and that harvested food off the land should only be for Indigenous people. So I really feel that there's a lot more honest conversations to be had because I am a settler from the South, but I choose to live here. And so by not being allowed to support my hunters and trappers and fisher people here, I am not able to support my local community. And I understand the ideas of environment and economy and ecology and all those things and how they're all intertwined and that you don't want to have people that are selling to everybody to overharvest. But also when I see people who are great hunters, I have a good friend who is a great hunter. And every once in a while, he'll drop off a chunk of moose for me or he'll drop off some hooves or for my dogs or something. And I always want to pay him. And his answer is no, because culturally we don't take money. But then I know he could have used that money to pay his electricity bill, who will not take moose. There needs to be some sort of conversation around who's local, who's not local. I'm not Indigenous. I do not hunt this land and I only fish where I'm allowed because it's not my right. It's not my land. But I would like to support the people in the local food movement, whatever that looks like. And what we were finding in the community is what was really great is the people that were there who were Indigenous, who were on the outskirts of the food movement. So they're not hunters. They're not fisher people. They have children and can't go out on the land and gather as easily as they'd like to. They worked in the greenhouse. So then when somebody comes back with that quarter of a moose and says, here you go, poor woman who can't go hunt because you're a single woman with three kids, she could say, here you go, here's 25 pounds of potatoes. Thank you for the work you've done. So I think the conversation is two-sided. How do we encourage local practices of trading and of sharing, but also look at the people who live here who don't have that option, who potentially could pay and be a part of that system without destroying the ecosystem and overstepping boundaries and making it more of an us as an all-inclusive for everyone that lives in that community instead of a us versus them within the community. And I love to have those conversations because they're difficult ones. And they're ones that I think until we all agree to, you know, look at how colonized our lifestyle is and the fact that there are settlers who live in Indigenous lands and that's not going to change. But how do we work together so that my money that I make in the North stays in the North and helps my community? Because as much as I appreciate farmers in the South, I don't live in the South. If I lived in the South, I'd buy from those farmers, but I don't want to buy my eggs from Manitoba. I don't want to buy my beef from Alberta. And I get it from the Yukon, which is the closest, but I want us to be doing it here. And I want us to be supporting here. And I want us to be creating jobs here. And while trucks are going to come in no matter what, I want less trucks to come up that road and then support the food here.
Are there exceptions? Like in Newfoundland, my neighbor could give me a bunch of moose, but I can't pay him for it. But I can go to the restaurant and I can buy a moose burger. So there's an exception. Is that the case in some of the tourist industry?
So where I live, it's really hard to say because we don't really have a lot of options. Like, yes, Alistine serves local whitefish. So yes, there are exceptions, but you have to have a proper commercial license. And supposedly there is a way that you can sell at the market, but it's really unclear and most people just don't bother. And that's the problem. It shouldn't be unclear. It should be open and honest. And hey, you can do this, but you can't do that. So when somebody sells dry fish on the internet, until it gets taken down, you can buy it. But is that right? It's a hard thing. And like, there are workarounds. And I know that in Yellowknife, you can get stuff and that in Whitehorse as well. And there are bison farms and elk farms and things. But as for my particular area, it's hard to support the local food initiatives. And so for me, and I, when I see a local family saying, yeah, I want chickens, that tells me that that already is people choosing, okay, you know, I used to go out and get goose egg. Well, there's not as many anymore. So how do we sustain ourselves? And that's the other shift. There shouldn't be shame tied to growing your own food, because I know that was a part of it as well. I mean, when you look at residential schools, there was a lot of shame in that because you're forced to garden and you're forced to look after the farm, but you weren't allowed to reap any of the benefits. And so it has this negative connotation that we are constantly battling. I hear that all the time. We don't garden. No, you also don't eat hamburgers and you don't get coffee from the corner store. So now you do those things. So let's be honest, you know, let's talk about tradition, but you don't live 100% traditional lifestyle. And I had a really good, I was at a roundtable discussion for food security in the North. And I said, I think we should be building a year-round greenhouse to help take some of the space out of the trucks so other things can come up here. And the guy sitting next to me, he says, Indigenous people don't eat vegetables. We need more bullets for guns. And stopped my conversation in the tracks because he's the head of the Hunters and Trappers Association. And this happened like 6 years ago. I was still fresh, new to the community. And I'm at a conference a year later in Edmonton, sitting with all the, you know, heads of the Inuvialuit, head of Wichin, the mayor, the SAO, all these people from Inuvik. And we're trying to like talk about food security and all these things. And I told the story of this guy. And I said at the time, we were all eating caribou stew, having this conversation. And I wanted to turn to him and say, what part of the caribou does the carrot, the potato, and the onion in my beautiful caribou stew come from? Because my anatomy is a little unclear, but I thought, oh, that's rude. And so I said this at the table, and the guy sitting next to me eating prime rib and Caesar salad starts choking. He's laughing so hard. And the guy across the table said, Ray, I'd like to introduce you to Dan Grubin, the head of the Hunters and Trappers. And he said, it was me. I said that. But it's true. And these are conversations we don't have. People don't necessarily just live off caribou anymore. They don't live off just fish anymore. And the thing is, that's their choice. And it should be their choice. It should be anyone's choice. Do I want to have avocado toast tomorrow and I live in the Arctic? Do I want to have muktuk tomorrow and I live in wherever? This should be a choice. And that's what food sovereignty is about. Not just food security, is that choice that shouldn't be forced upon anyone. If you want to live in a small Indigenous community and have chickens, awesome. You want to have goats? Fantastic. Yeah. You want to live off the local meat you fish and you hunt yourself? Also your choice.
As you see communities in the North develop an interest in food security and move forward, is there a common set of characteristics? Is it individuals who have the passion like you have right now who kind of move councils, or is it from above where you give them a greenhouse? Like what kind of works in your experience there?
So the original model that I worked with back in 2015, they were given greenhouses and told, go forth and grow. That doesn't work. And this is the big focus. And actually with Green Igloo, this is something I want to make very clear. These are not our projects. While we reach out to communities and tell them what we can do, we don't actually come up with the project. We give them ideas. Here's the options, but they're always community centered. And those are the projects that work. Communities that have come together. But what usually ends up happening is it's one person who's passionate. 90% of the time, it's one person who's passionate, who's not from there, who doesn't have longevity. And the communities that I see as working are the ones in which the communities actually have sought buy-in already, that have already had community consultation, that have already decided we are serious about this. We've put in the time, and we also have local people who want to do this and do this as a job. We need to stop treating greenhouses and food production and food security initiatives as a hobby that people can volunteer their time for. Because most of the time that food is required because food is expensive and people can't afford it. So if you can't afford to go to the store and buy your own food, how can you be expected to go work for free in a community garden to get your your food. That's not right. We need to treat it as an actual economic base. And I had these arguments with Canor. Shout out to Canor. You're great. They are, and they're wonderful. But we had these arguments is how is a greenhouse anything to do with economic development when you consider a greenhouse costs money? You're never going to sell enough lettuce to pay back that $150,000. Well, here's the thing. I moved to Inuvik when I could have moved anywhere else because Inuvik had a greenhouse that I knew I could grow food part of the year. People are moving to Inuvik now because there's a hydroponics facility and they know they can get fresh vegetables 12 months of the year. So having a greenhouse, having a chicken coop, having a mushroom farm, having those sorts of things tells the people living in the community when that road closes and the trucks stop running, I'm still going to be able to eat. And that is the most important thing of all. We are bringing in people because we need more people living in the north. No matter what anyone says, we need doctors, we need teachers, we need nurses. And until we educate enough people in the north to stay in the north, we still need people to come in and we need to have a draw. And having food that is fresh and local is a huge draw to anyone considering the north.
When I realized that this interview would take up two shows, I got back in touch with Ray and asked her for a second music choice. She suggested something that made reference to cold and chose Simon and Garfunkel's A Hazy Shade of Winter. Hazy Shade of Winter by Simon and Garfunkel, as requested by my guest, Ray Solotke. Today, she's speaking to us from her home in Inuvik, Northwest Territories. In this section, we start by noting the importance of local food production in attracting and keeping residents to a community or a region.
We talk about having a need for education and medical care, that sort of infrastructure in order to attract people, but we don't often say local food production infrastructure in areas where transportation is dicey at the best of times.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, at the very end of the day, what do you need to survive? You need food, water, and shelter. That's it. That's really all you need to survive in this world. And people have survived in the harsh Arctic conditions because they figured out how to get those things. And the problem is, as the world changes, food is becoming a scarcer commodity. And so we need to find ways that don't rely on trucks. And I think this winter really showed us all how much we are beholden to truck drivers and transportation networks and roads being open and how eye-opening it is for even people in the South who saw empty shelves. It was huge for people in the South. That is our weekly reality. The day before the truck gets in, it's dire. The day the truck was supposed to get in, it's really dire. 2 weeks later, we're out of food. And that is the reality.
So you don't have a whole bunch of tweets of empty shelves as soon as somebody sees one. That is what happens in the South.
You know what? We're all just used to it. Honestly, when the pandemic hit, and I think a lot of other remote community people would tell you this, I think we were already set up for success because people don't hoard here. So we didn't have those who have the money running out and taking all the supplies, because that was a huge issue, right? People running out and buying all the supplies. Well, if you live paycheck to paycheck, you can't afford to buy 6 months worth of supplies. But for us, we all have enough in our houses to last us probably a month, if not more, because we've had to slowly stockpile over time because we know the road could go out. So we don't have to run out and buy a month's worth of groceries. We probably already have it. And also we care about our community members, just like other small communities, that I'm not going to take the last of everything because somebody who couldn't afford to stockpile 6 weeks doesn't have it in their cupboard.
That's a really good point. So you don't have huge stockpiles of toilet paper anywhere in the closets of your community.
The stockpiles that I have are weird. I have stockpiles of dog food and chicken food.
Well, the chicken and dog food, you're thinking of them, not you. You know, you're thinking of
exactly.
Your animals. That's right.
And that actually also is a really interesting thing about the small communities. You know, I put out a call out to say, my chickens are starving. Does anyone have any freezer burnt food or like off vegetables? I will literally come and take your garbage. I got over 200 pounds of off vegetables and meat donated to me within 30 minutes in this. I just stopped people. I was like, I can't handle this anymore. I just can't store it anywhere. But people are so generous in the communities, in any community. If you reach out and say, I need help, you have it in a heartbeat, whether they're your friend or your family or your foe. They've got your back. And I think this is why looking at local food security is really important, because you ask the question of who's doing this work. Maybe it's one passionate individual. Maybe it's one government agency who is looking to have a deliverable by the end of fiscal. But the reality is that the community, if they have buy-in and if they have interest, they are going to be the ones that champion it for the next 20, 30, 40 years and help it to grow.
So Green Igloo, you work with communities who are looking at food security options for their communities. Are there northern communities in general?
So originally, Green Igloo was a company that started their base doing hydroponics inside geodesic domes in Arviat and Nauyat in Nunavut. That's how it got started, as Growing North, as a part of a Ryerson class project, actually. And then the founders kind of moved it forward into a charity. And when I took over in August, there were like 6 or 7 builds. Nauyat and Arviat are not operational right now because of COVID. We haven't been able to go up there, but we have about 12 builds this summer to increase. And to be honest, we're everywhere. So we have a build almost completed in Lac Colombes, British Columbia, which is a remote indigenous community that you have to catch a ferry from Prince Rupert. And this is a really cool one because this was created by the students at the school. When COVID hit, the ferry stopped running. There's no real grocery store in Lac Colombes. So the only lifeblood they have to groceries is that ferry that runs every single day. So they saw an opportunity to grow food in their community to help make sure that everyone was going to be safe in the future. And so that's what that project is about, is creating some sustainability in that community. And it was started by a group of high school students. We have a build in Gaspé-Gagliac in Quebec that is attached to a wellness center. And it is a project where they're looking at healing and the healing components. And it is basically a youth drug and alcohol center. And so they want to not only grow for themselves, but basically it's an idea of this intake grows for the next intake to eat. Mm. So you're always looking after the next people in line. We have communities in Nunatukavut that they're building their second dome this year, and they're not operational yet. We're still in the process of finishing. Roxanne Notley, who you met in our webinars, she's the leader on that. And that's all about bringing these projects to as many of the communities as possible and showing them how it can be done so that ownership will be taken. So Roxanne is taking ownership of these communities right now, but the hope is that they'll run themselves by the interest we gauge from the communities as we're there for community engagement. So coast to coast to coast, we have domes, and we're hoping, honestly, we've been kind of linked with Just Growing Domes. Ben Canning, who is the founder of Arctic Acres, the manufacturer of those domes in Canada, he was one of the original founders of Green Igloo. And so we've been linked to Just Growing Domes, but the reality is growing domes are expensive and not everyone can afford a $55,000 growing dome. So we're looking at working on other projects that are are realistic to the community and what they have. I spoke to someone this morning in Nunavik regarding the retrofit of a building, working with Coldacre for some hydroponics to put in there and working on soil-based structures and basically taking whatever the community wants to do. We want to be the tool that helps them. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, most of these communities do not have a food security project manager who can say, spend 6 months researching the options. They can come to us and say, we want to do this in 4 or 5 years. What are our options? Here's our budget. And we can help them. We also work with foundations that help us with funding, that help us find funding, that help us find ways for them to do things. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to be the tool that they use to get to the end. And that's all. And we want to make sure that our pricing structure isn't an elitist pricing structure. If you come to me and say, I want this initiative, and I say, great, you got $275,000. How does that help anybody? If you are struggling with food security, do you have $275,000 lying around? No, you would just go and buy another grocery store and stock it full of the things you wanted. So the reality is we need to find ways to do it cheaper. But we're also developing something called the Tomorrow's Harvest Fund, in which we take extra donations that we have. And when a community comes to us, which just actually happened, a community came to us, they had tried to come up with $120,000 for their dome. And they want to do this with outdoor gardens and cold frames and education. And they struggled. They got $100,000. So we are going to take $20,000 out of our Tomorrow Harvest Fund, which is the entire Tomorrow's Harvest Fund right now. And we're going to make sure that they get their projects and that they do not have to scrimp and we do not have to cut corners. And instead, we're going to work together to partner on getting that done, because at the end of the day, we're all here for the same thing.
Yeah.
We want food. We want empowerment. We want jobs. We want all of those things. And we want them to better each of these small communities. So the people that currently live in those small communities say, why would I leave? Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow.
Recorded live in their famous concert in Central Park in New York City. That was Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel with the song A Hazy Shade of Winter. What do they know of winter in New York City? But in Inuvik, where my guest is at the moment, winter is rather well known. I'm speaking with Ray Solotkey in the Northwest Territories. We start this final section by talking about some of the frustrations of nurturing food production in northern and remote regions and reflect on the many difficult conversations we need to be having.
I also am on the board of directors of the Territorial Agri-Foods Association. I just came from a meeting in Hay River where the board of directors sat and met, and we talked about this, and it's actually very hard because it's also infantilizing. We have large-scale food producers in the Northwest Territories, and they're not given the credit they should be because it's just a small company in the Arctic or in the North. If you are producing food in the North, you should be getting a lot more credit than you are. And the hard part is, and I'm sure you're used to this too, where you are, for us, I went to Hay River this weekend from Inuvik. Now, if you look on a map and you look where Inuvik is and you look where Hay River is, I once had a phone call from Sears telling me that my order was in Hay River. Could I just pop over and get it? You know how to get to Hay River from Inuvik? You drive from Inuvik through the Yukon, through British Columbia, through Alberta, back up into the Northwest Territory. It is a 48-hour drive. It is a $3,000 flight in my own territory. It's insanity. So you have large-scale food producers or even smaller-scale food producers. Who cares? Commercial food producers in our territory, and I can't buy their product because we have no supply chain. It is incredibly frustrating. And so how do you manage areas that need food production, that have food production, that can't get their own local food production? That's ridiculous. It's faster to get from California to me than it is from within my own territory to me. We have serious problems in how we look at our food production and how we're spending our money on getting our food onto our plates.
I first met you in Finland somewhere, wasn't it? The home of Santa Claus.
Yes, we went to the Circumpolar Agricultural Conference.
Do you find that collaborating or talking to people in other circumpolar areas is a different kind of a relationship than if you talk to people who are working on agriculture and food security in the South, in your own country?
Yes, I think it's really interesting. We all have the same idea. Everybody you talk to Institute in the northern part of Canada thinks they are the first person to invent a northern greenhouse. And I said that to someone today on the phone. I said, I'm so sorry, that came out wrong. I meant that with all due respect. I meant that as you don't have support because you feel this is a new project. But unfortunately, those projects exist everywhere. We're just not sharing the information. And what's happening is somebody very passionate and exciting wants to do this thing. And they go to do this thing and it's hard. It's really hard. And they feel alone and they feel like nobody understands. And guess what? There's hundreds of us, maybe thousands of us doing this work all across the north of Canada and all across the circumpolar north, that we should be sharing our network and sharing our information. One of the things that we're trying to do at Green Igloo is to create a portal. One of the very easiest ways, if you wanted to be a part of the Green Igloo team and family and be, have your community get started on greenhouse initiatives, is we sell an education package. It is a 3-module system that has 13 to 17 chapters per module on everything from germination to chicken coops to market gardens to hydroponics. You buy that package and you have a lifetime of education with Green Igloo, including access to our webinars, access to our portals, access to weekly webinars and seminars, so that you are no longer alone and you have access to a community chat system where somebody who is in Newfoundland and Labrador can say, I'm having a really hard time growing X, Y, and Z. Anyone had any luck in a similar situation? Because if you go online, you look up anything to do with greenhouses, I have no idea what zone I'm in. I'm not in a zone. I'm in zone 0. And what difference does it make when you don't have a road to get you the stuff on time? I need more help. I need understanding. I need to know, like, my hydroponics broke. This piece doesn't work. I can't get it shipped in for 6 weeks. Has anyone ever fixed this? Yeah, I sure have. Go get this piece from this plumbing store that you definitely have because it fits on a toilet and you can fix it. And that's the kind of conversation and community we need to develop across Canada. We just aren't collaborating. We are working in silos and this is going to destroy us.
You sort of talked earlier about this, but I'm increasingly interested in the connection between food and therapy, basically.
Yes.
It seems like that's one of the things that you've talked about a little bit as well, is just that the action of growing food is such an optimistic and life-affirming thing that it leads to other things as well, not just the food.
100%. And I mentioned this before, and I think you were at this webinar where Mayor from Nourish talked about the course, Food is Our Medicine. Yeah. And it is a specifically, you know, decolonizing the food systems within healthcare, but there is something so healing about food. I was saying to someone the other day, my love language is food. I feed people that I love. It's very hard for me to talk to people about trauma. I can talk about anything else, but with trauma, I have a really hard time when people are struggling. Yeah. I don't know what to say. So for me, my love language is to make them a meal and show up with a meal and fill their fridge, because food is healing. And when my mental health is bad, I struggle to feed myself. And I think a lot of people find that. I don't look after myself. And if I don't put food in my body, I can't do the things I want to do. And so food is the thing that brings us together. I've said that I start my classes and my gardening courses with food preservation. I do that so we can sit down and eat and we can have a conversation. And so that connection of eating and talking is so healing. Putting your hands in the ground is so healing. And more people are really understanding that connection these days. There's studies done about microbes in soil that increase serotonin and all these things. And I'm not a scientist in that aspect, so I don't know the deal, but I know I'm happiest when I'm in the garden. I know I'm happiest when I'm eating food with friends, and I am happiest when I'm eating something delicious and juicy. And yesterday I cooked caribou for my dogs, some freezer burned caribou. You have never seen happier dogs. They get eggs. They're happy little puppies. They had caribou yesterday. They have never been so calm and happy and got along so well, because food is nourishing for everybody, everything. And so, you know, food security is one thing. If you don't have enough to eat, that's terrifying. But food sovereignty and having the choice of what makes you happy and what you eat, it's huge. I don't want to live on Soylent Green.
Well, what's one of your favorite foods?
Actually, my family is Ukrainian. I have another hat up here and I am the pierogi lady. So I make and sell pierogies at our farmer's market. Pierogies are my food. I have a 4-ingredient, amazing recipe that people will text me in the middle of the night and say, can you make pierogies soon? I love cheese and meat. I'm a charcuterie girl. So that's what I love. And you can't grow those in a greenhouse, unfortunately, but you can make your own cheese if you get goats, just a little aside.
I was wondering if you had done a northern adaptation of the pierogi, like if you put a bit of caribou in one.
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. I even put in cheese that I made myself because we had none in the store. I don't use eggs, but if I did, I would use mine. But I've used, you know, garlic and herbs that I've grown myself. Yep. I tried it once I did brute ones and I did local berries. Yeah, you can do all sorts of stuff. I love the merging of food. There's a lot of great indigenous chefs actually out there that merge a lot of traditional and non-traditional foods, which is really how I see things being the most beneficial in the future.
I was going to ask you a bit about what you were going to miss about the North, but it's too raw at this point because you're moving.
It's an easy question. The people in the North, whether they love you or they hate you, if you need them, they will have your back in a heartbeat. And that is something you can't recreate anywhere else. There's something special about people in the North.
Can't be said any better. Thanks so much.
It was lovely to see you, Ivan. Thank you so much for including me on your podcast.
If you'd like to look up the organization Ray works for, you can head onto the virtual highway and point your browser to greenigloo.com. Igloo is spelled I-G-L-U.
So having a greenhouse, having a chicken coop, having a mushroom farm, having those sorts of things tells the people living in the community, when that road closes and the trucks stop running, I'm still going to be able to eat. But how do we work together so that my money that I make in the North stays in the North and helps my community? I know I'm happiest when I'm in the garden. I know I'm happiest when I'm eating food with friends. And I am happiest when I'm eating something delicious and juicy and The day before the truck gets in, it's dire. The day the truck was supposed to get in, it's really dire. 2 weeks later, we're out of food. And that is the reality.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of this show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. On today's show, we heard A Hazy Shade of Winter by Simon & Garfunkel, recorded in a park in New York City. The theme music, Cluck Old Hen, was performed this week by Dave Dillard and Maddie Denton, recorded in a cabin in Tennessee. Two very different recording contexts. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time. I'll be right here. Happy trails.
There's something special about people in the North.